Hello there. Today is Wednesday, January 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Barack Obama gives an emotional final farewell speech.
We must guard against a weakening of the values that make us who we are.
The first of Donald Trump's cabinet nominees gets grilled in Washington.
These are damnably false charges.
Also ahead, new music from a rising British singer-songwriter. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the 44th president of the United States, Barack Obama, gave his farewell address in his hometown of Chicago, thanking thousands of supporters and reaffirming his belief in the power of change. Obama was hearkening back to the message of his first campaign for president in 2008. In the aftermath of Republican Donald Trump's election, Obama is acknowledging that the nation's progress has been uneven, but touted it.
If I had told you 8 years ago that America would reverse a great recession, reboot our auto industry, and unleash the longest stretch of job creation in our history, if I had told you that we would open up a new chapter with the Cuban people, shut down Iran's nuclear weapons program without firing a shot, take out the mastermind of 9/11, if I had told you that we would win marriage equality and secure the right to health insurance for another 20 million of our fellow citizens, if I had told y'all that, you might have said our sights were set a little too high. But that's what we did. That's what you did. You were the change. You answered people's hopes. And because of you, by almost every measure, America is a better, stronger place than it was when we started.
Obama also thanked his daughters, his staff, Vice President Biden, and his wife, First Lady Michelle.
You took on a role you didn't ask for, and you made it your own, with grace and with grit and with style and good humor. You made the White House a place that belongs to everybody. And a new generation sets its sights higher because it has you as a role model. So you have made me proud, and you have made the country proud.
Let's get more analysis now on this speech. VOA's Victor Beatty talked about the speech with Larry Sabato, director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia.
It was a very moving farewell. Certainly, it was untraditional. We've never had a farewell address like this. One can only imagine what George Washington, or for that matter, Dwight Eisenhower, who had the most famous farewell address, would have thought of this manner of delivering it. It was more like a political rally. The speech itself was moving, and it read well if you had the text. I think it was an undignified setting. Somebody forgot to tell the audience that a farewell address is a dignified occasion. This was really the last Obama rally. So I think it really made it less effective than it would have been otherwise. The shouts and the cheers and the applause actually cut into some of the best lines. So, you know, maybe I'm just revealing my age. Maybe I'm just too old-fashioned, but I'm not a fan of doing this, but I can tell you already, whether it's 2021 or 2025, Donald Trump will do his to a giant rally. He'll make sure that there are 2 or 3 or 10 times more people at his than there was at Barack Obama. So I think it has set a bad precedent.
Did Mr. Obama's speech have any veiled references to the president-elect?
Oh, of course. Now, he was gracious at one point and encouraged the crowd that clearly was not particularly enamored of Donald Trump to support a transition, a good transition, which he's tried to do. But really, most of the speech was about positions that he has taken and achievements that he has been able to make during his presidency that Donald Trump wants to reverse or abolish. And truth be told, in a year or two or three, when we think back on this speech, we're going to realize that most of what President Obama talked about is no longer reality. Elections have consequences, and this one has gigantic consequences.
In terms
of Obama's legacy is a pale shadow of what it might have been had Hillary Clinton won.
What are the grand changes that you anticipate?
Well, Obamacare is gone. Whether it takes a month or 4 years, it's gone. And there will be bits and pieces of it preserved, but it's going to be called Trump Care or GOP Care, and it's going to be based on more free market principles rather than the plan we've come to know. And that's the biggest part of his legacy, other than the personal legacy of being the first African-American president. Climate change, obviously, the new president doesn't believe in that. Immigration and the young immigrants, the Dreamers, I think a lot of the new rules on immigration will be quite harsh. I can't see a lot of daylight for most of the Obama programs and principles.
He talked a lot about the state of our democracy. What is that state in your view after 8 years?
But it's also true that we're more divided than ever. Now, part of that is directly tied to the outcome of this election. President Trump, as we all know, has lost the popular vote by a wide margin. And the early polling for him is as bad. Actually, it's worse than for any president in the age of polling. There's just never been a situation like this.
He indicated at the end of his speech that he's more optimistic about the country than he was when he started.
Well, he's probably one of the only people who is more optimistic. I've found a deep pessimism. Republicans are pessimistic because they think some things are irretrievable after the Obama years, and Democrats are almost unanimously pessimistic because they regard Donald Trump at best as an aberration. It goes downhill from there in their descriptions, most of which I can't say to you on family radio.
All right. Well, political science professor at the University of Virginia, Larry Sabato, speaking to VOA's Victor Beatty. With just days remaining before the inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump, his transition team is preparing to hit the ground running on January 20th when he will be sworn in as the 45th president of the United States. VOA's Elizabeth Chernoff looks back at key highlights of the transition period that began after he was elected this past November.
I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans, and this is so important to me.
It's one of the pillars of American democracy, the peaceful transition of power from one commander-in-chief to another.
We talked about
on the heels
policy,
of his victory, President-elect Trump met with President Obama at the White House, where both pledged to cooperate going forward.
We now are going to want to do everything we can to help you succeed, because if you succeed, then the country succeeds.
Mr. President, it was a great honor being with you, and I look forward to being with you many, many more times in the future. Thank you, sir.
The process of transition between incoming and outgoing administrations is challenging and cumbersome, but that didn't stop Trump from going on a cross-country victory tour to thank his supporters.
They're saying, as president, He shouldn't be doing rallies, but I think we should, right?
He also broke with tradition on several cabinet appointments, nominating Washington outsiders such as ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State, and financier and former Goldman Sachs executive Steven Mnuchin as Treasury Secretary. And in his signature style, President-elect Trump continued tweeting with harsh words for his critics and praise for others, like Russian President Vladimir Putin, despite U.S. intelligence reports of Russian hacking and attempts to influence the 2016 election. Despite a somewhat unpredictable transition process that will include Senate hearings for the cabinet nominees, experts say the incoming administration is well prepared to assume office later this month.
Certainly, we've seen some unprecedented actions with this president-elect. But by and large, in terms of naming their people, we're in pretty good shape, but that's no measuring stick for success. President-elect Trump needs his team on the field on Inauguration Day, prepared and ready to go.
All eyes are focused on the nation's capital as the next president of the United States prepares to take the oath of office in the coming days. Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at voanews.com. Dylan Roof is sentenced to death in the slaying of 9 black church members. American charged with attempted murder of a diplomat in Mexico. San Bernardino gunman's brother pleads guilty to immigration fraud. Life under Islamic State rule, a wife's tale after husband defies IS. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, President-elect Donald Trump's choice for Attorney General, defended his civil rights record Tuesday, telling a congressional hearing that he understands the tortured history of voting rights for blacks in the United States.
I was accused in 1986 of failing to protect the voting rights of African Americans by presenting the Perry County case, the voter fraud case, and of condemning civil rights advocates and organizations, and even harboring, amazingly, sympathies for the KKK. These are damnably false charges.
Sessions is the first of Trump's cabinet nominees facing a Senate confirmation hearing this week, and he assured his colleagues on the Judiciary Committee that he'd lead aggressive enforcement of U.S. voting laws without hindrance or discrimination and to ensure the integrity of the electoral process. Joining me now for more on this hearing, New York criminal defense lawyer Kenneth Perry of the Perry firm Perry and Aronin. What were your observations, sir, on how Sessions handled the issues of civil rights and race?
That's been an interesting issue. I mean, he sat there in his opening statement and said how, you know, I wasn't prepared and I didn't know how to answer, and therefore things were taken out of context. I don't think that's much of an excuse for somebody who's supposedly a top ability lawyer, you know, especially if you are a litigator, which is what he holds himself out to be or had been at that time. You have to think fast on your feet. And if you're saying that, well, you know, here are these questions, I didn't know they were going to come, therefore I didn't prepare for them, that sort of smacked, well, had I known, I would have prepared some answer that would have hidden things. You know, other than that statement and then all the glad-handing and stroking that was done by the Republicans and other senators, I didn't hear anything that really answered the questions that were brought up or the issues that were brought up back in the 70s or 60s. I don't really think it's been that addressed, and I think it's never going to be.
There were a lot of topics that were covered. He was asked about his votes on the use of torture, the use of waterboarding. Do you think that his answers satisfied those who were skeptical in that regard?
The way you worded that is satisfied those who were skeptical. I don't think anything he is going to say is going to satisfy those who are skeptical. And if you look at his answer, he said, yes, I think it is torture. But he also predicated it on saying that he didn't necessarily feel that way when there was another decision by, I think it was a presidential finding, and then when the Senate deemed that it was improper, that's when he decided, yes, that's what the law is, so it's improper. That doesn't answer the question about what is his view. He's been very careful not to give his view about most things.
Well, he has for quite a while, given his views about the use of marijuana. He was also asked about that because across the United States, as you know, marijuana is becoming either legal for medicinal purposes or full-on legal for recreational purposes in many states, including the state that he represents, Alabama. He was asked how he would handle the state laws versus the federal law, which still says marijuana use is illegal. What was his response, and did he make it clear on how he would deal with that?
You know, he was asked as part of that if he would follow the current rules in the Department of Justice of basically turning an eye away from it, especially in cases where medical issues are involved. And his answer was, I'd have to make, you know, a case-by-case decision, is basically what he said. You know, then he said, well, you know, I'm aware of our economic resource issues, and that would come into what we would decide to prosecute and what we would decide not to. But he did not rule out, especially in cases of medical issues, he did not rule out prosecuting people. And I think there's going to be some surprise people who have, let's say, maybe invested deeply into marijuana industries, or people who are relying in on states on the allowance to have medical marijuana, who might find it not as easy to get as it was.
He was also asked if he would recuse himself if for some reason legal issues came up regarding the Trump presidential campaign, because it would be a conflict of interest given that Donald Trump was the one that nominated him. He didn't really seem to answer that question.
He did not.
Was that your impression?
My impression throughout almost all of this confirmation hearing is he has skillfully, but nonetheless, not answered anything. He has sidestepped most issues. And I don't know whether that's because of the way the format of the hearings are. These people are stopped after 5, 10, 15 minutes. You know, then the next person comes up and does a repaint job to say, oh, I've known him for so long and he's so wonderful. So there's never been any in-depth delving into what he will or will not do. And I don't think he's, in most things, have really said what he would do other than follow the law.
Hmm. Okay, so overall, how did he do as far as the job that he was tasked to do, which was to get through this?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at it from the party who wants him there, I think he's done very well. If you look from the viewpoint of the party who has questions and doesn't want him there, I think he's not done so well. But I think he's going to be confirmed. The Republicans have the majority. It'd have to be something awfully big to stop him.
That's New York criminal defense attorney Kenneth Perry of the firm Perry & Aronin. This is International Edition.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Volkswagen executive who once was in charge of complying with U.S. emissions regulations was arrested over the weekend in the U.S. state of Florida. Oliver Schmidt, who was general manager of the Engineering and Environmental Office for VW of America, was charged in a criminal complaint with conspiracy to defraud the government in the U.S. and of wire fraud. He's the second VW employee to be arrested into this probe, which was led by the U.S. Attorney's Office. It does continue. Volkswagen has admitted it programmed diesel-powered vehicles to turn pollution controls on during tests and to turn them off in real-world driving. Joining me now for more on this is environmental attorney Daniel Reisel. What did you make of the arrest on Monday?
This arrest is sort of the next shoe dropping, I predicted. When the engineer that they had extracted a plea from early on would be the first step in the Department of Justice attempt to see how far up the line of command the scienter went, or the actual knowledge of the crime.
So you weren't surprised. Do you think there will be more arrests? Do you think there are more people involved in this cover-up, alleged cover-up?
Well, I mean, that's something which you can only speculate on. But on the other hand, it's the Department of Justice procedure to follow, to pursue this until the line of evidence is exhausted. And the way that it usually works is that cooperating parties who start at the bottom or actually at any opportunity that presents itself, it depends who walks in the door or who you have knowledge of. For example, if you have fairly substantial knowledge of a low-level employee who has been involved in these actions, which the government says is criminal, you then proceed against that person, either by indicting that person or striking up a plea bargain with them or a plea arrangement, which can involve an actual plea, an agreement on sentencing, or just an agreement to testify in lieu of an indictment. And it varies. The procedures vary from prosecutorial offices.
This is a criminal case, so this is criminal conspiracy charges. So what kind of punishment would go with something like this, or what could he be facing? And he's not, it looks like he's not an American citizen.
His citizenship doesn't matter.
Okay. So what kind of punishment would he be facing?
There are substantial fines and substantial incarceration for violations of the Environmental Protection Act and for making false statements or defrauding the American government. Substantial years of incarceration.
Environmental attorney Daniel Reisel. Let's turn now to what's been trending on social media with G. Abby Lee. Hey, G, what's going on?
Hi, Lori. The inauguration for U.S. President-elect Donald Trump is only 10 days away, so there's going to be a lot of buzz around it leading up to the event. One of the top trending stories this Wednesday is no exception. Many Hollywood stars are tweeting about their plans to attend the Women's March in the nation's capital a day after the inauguration. More than 100,000 people are expected to participate in this march.
Right. I know there are a ton of celebrities. Mm-hmm. Who are they?
So pop singers Katy Perry and Cher, as well as actors Scarlett Johansson, Julianne Moore, and Amy Schumer. Perry tweeted, in all caps, sisters are doing it for themselves.
Wow. Okay, so speaking of which, we do have some sad news regarding a pioneering female journalist. Mm-hmm. What's the internet reaction about that?
Yeah, many journalists, men and women alike, are sharing condolences for the late Claire Hollingworth. The British war correspondent passed away Tuesday at the age of 105. She broke the news on the start of World War II with a scoop about German troop movements on the Polish border. At that time, she worked for the Daily Telegraph. You can find links to obituaries from The Guardian and BuzzFeed and much more on Twitter.
All right. Anything else going on?
Let's talk retail. A Canadian company buying American apparel is trending, and you can guess why. American industry insiders are tweeting it feels unfortunate that a company called American Apparel is being rescued at the 11th hour by Canadians. A Montreal-based clothing company, Gildan Activewear, is paying $88 million in cash for the AA brand, but not its retail stores. Back to you, Lori.
Thanks so much, G. You can follow her, by the way, at G. Abby Lee. Well, a British singer-songwriter just released two singles. Border Crossing's host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to tell us about those songs.
Today's discussion is Ed Sheeran, who is a British singer-songwriter. He's great at doing both of those things. He's a talented singer. His hit Thinking Out Loud won him two Grammys a few years back. He's coming back now with a brand new album. He surprised everyone with two new songs on the internet on Friday, and that's kind of the subject of today's segment on International Edition. Shape of You and Castle on the Hill are the two new singles, which have just set a brand new Spotify download record, even topping One Direction. So Ed Sheeran came out with the new songs, and each one has been downloaded within 24 hours 6 million times. And this is Friday within that 24-hour span. So 12 million downloads for the two songs total. Since that time, of course, there's been many more downloads, and they continue even as we speak. But Shape of You was a song that Ed wrote, he said, with Rihanna in mind. That's kind of who he was thinking about when he put the song together. And he decided to sing it himself. I like it. It's a kind of a happy, upbeat, catchy tune in a very Ed Sheeran sound and style. So let's check it out. Singing like, girl, you know I want your love. Your love was handmade for somebody like me. Come on now, follow my lead.
And the other song?
The other song is called Castle on the Hill, and he said that he wrote that song about his hometown, Suffolk, England. And he said that he shot the music video for the song in Suffolk, and the cast in the video are former high school students who went to school with him. In fact, he said there's a guy who looks just like me in the video. Weirdly enough, he's a classmate of mine from sixth grade. So very interesting. The album, which is called Divide, kind of strange. You know, Ed's had an interesting set of titles for his albums over the years. He's released two others. This is his third album. The first one was Plus Sign. The second one in 2014 was Multiply. And now this one is a Divide, a division symbol, Divide. Mm-hmm. And so it is coming out. It's expected out at the end of June, the album itself. But during the course of the next few months, Ed is going to become more and more visible. He's expected to perform on the Brit Awards show in February and make an appearance at the Grammys and Glastonbury Music Festival. He's going to perform there. So you're going to see a lot more Ed Sheeran before he actually releases his album then goes out on tour. The new album, as I mentioned, features John Mayer, who plays guitar on a couple of tracks. And it's been about 10 months since Ed's been on social media, but he's back. And yeah, his very first tweet was just a divide symbol.
That's going to do it for today's show. We appreciate your being with us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Interfaith cooperation among religious communities around the world is a powerful counterbalance to hate, violence, and injustice, said U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, David Saperstein. This is especially true in countries afflicted by sectarian violence. In Kenya, for example, when Islamist gunmen suspected to be al-Shabaab attacked a bus in December 2015 and demanded that Christians and Muslims be separated, the driver of the bus said that the Muslims on board refused to be separated from their fellow Christian travelers. They told the militants to kill them all or leave them all alone, which incredibly the gunmen in the main did. Yet one man, Salah Farah, was injured while shielding Christians from the attack and later died. His brother Rashid told media that he hoped Salah's example would encourage Kenyans to live as one community and promote religious harmony. In Israel, there are examples of peace building through interfaith education that schools like the Tabitha School in Jaffa or the six hand-in-hand schools in cities all across Israel provide to Jewish, Muslim, Druze, and Christian students. In Turkey, members of Istanbul's tiny Greek Orthodox community, visitors from neighboring Greece and other faithful, attended an epiphany service led by Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew I, the spiritual leader of the world's Orthodox Christians in Istanbul, where the Patriarchate is based. A ceremony to bless the waters was also held in Izmir, Turkey's third largest city. It was the first official Epiphany ceremony there since the Greco-Turkish War ended in 1922, triggering a population exchange between Greece and Turkey. Although the Greek consulate in Izmir had organized a ceremony in 2006, it was the first time the Turkish government both approved and helped to organize it. It's a historic day here, and we're grateful to the local authorities and to the Patriarchate for making this happen, Tina Samolu, secretary of the Izmir Orthodox community, told Greek State TV. There is a power to be found when we advocate not just for people who share our beliefs, but also for those whose beliefs are profoundly different. When Jews advocate for Christians who are persecuted for their beliefs, when Christians advocate for Buddhists, when Hindus advocate for Muslims, when Muslims advocate for atheists, said Ambassador Saperstein. When we all recognize that if any one of us is not free to practice our beliefs, then none of us are.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's for what's your